Do you merely believe in God, or do you believe God? Most of the world believes in God or gods, and much of the world believes in the God. But the question I'm asking is, if you're hearing the difference, is do you believe God? It's one thing to think that God exists. It's quite another to trust Him. It's quite another to truly trust Him day to day with the stuff of our lives. Do you believe in Him? Or do you believe Him? Now, the evidence that many, even many of us in churches, believe in God but don't truly believe God is seen in the way that we live our lives. Too often our priorities are earthly and selfish rather than God's kingdom and truly altruistic. Too many times our morality is culturally conditioned and relativistic rather than biblically based and objective. Too often our charity is opportunistic and calculated rather than missional and sacrificial. We believe in God, but do we believe God? There may be some who have modified their outward actions and habits to conform to what their sense of an acceptable Christian does, but their hearts may not be changed. They are still in control of their jobs, their relationships, their leisure time, their money. Oh, they suspicion that they cannot control their eternal destinies, but not for lack of trying. They believe in God. The question is, do they believe God? In our study of the book of Exodus, we have come to the time in the narrative where God is about to lead the people of Israel, the descendants of Jacob, known as Israel, out of Egypt and into a land of their own. This would be the fulfillment of promises that had been made and repeated for over 500 years. The problem, of course, is that the promise has been obscured by nearly 400 years of slavery. Can you imagine a father telling his 10-year-old son about the promise that God had made 399 years earlier? Can you imagine that son hearing that promise and then watching his father and his grandfather being marched out again to the stone quarries as slaves? Can you imagine the boy's struggle to believe the promises when all evidence points to the disappearance of God and the futility of faith? Who of us, living under much less extreme conditions, has not felt something of that same struggle of faith? I believe in God. The question is, do I believe God? The descendants of Jacob, also known as Israel, as I said, are called the Israelites, and they probably numbered some 2 million people by the time that we are in the story, men, women, and children. I think that's about the same population as the greater Denver metro area, if you can just imagine that many people. Through the centuries, the people of Israel had become numerous enough to take the next step that God had in mind for them, but they were not ready. They were not emotionally or even spiritually ready. And what we're going to see in the text before us today is God's continuing preparation of the people, not just to believe in Him, but to truly reach the place in their lives where they believe Him sufficiently to stake their lives on Him. Freedom is not an easy thing to manage. It's one thing to be freed. It's quite another to know what to do with that freedom. Now, about 4 years ago, when my son Paris was 3, he decided to run away from home. I hope others of you have had that experience. He packed up a few things in a little bag, and he went out the front door. we decided to wait just a little bit to see what he might do, keeping an eye on the cul-de-sac in front of the house to see if he actually went down the street or not. Didn't see him going anywhere. We walked out the front door eventually, only to find him seated right there on the front step. He had no idea what to do. Many of us want freedom, but we're not yet ready for it. God's people were not ready yet for freedom, mainly because they had not yet come to the place of any more than believing in Him. They had not really yet come to the place of believing Him. The sermon this morning is without its ending. Now, that's not the same as saying it doesn't have an end. Okay? I know you're fearful that I've had 2 weeks and this thing could go on ad nauseum this morning. What I mean is that we're not going to actually hear the end of this sermon this week because we need a couple of more weeks really to develop this text, and there are some other things that we need to say about it. But how does God prepare His people to believe Him? How does God convince His people that they truly can trust Him, not just for the by and by, but they can trust Him here and now? That their God is sufficient to meet the need of the moment in their lives. To the Israelites, God may have seemed absent in the past, but what's going to happen in the text before us is that God is going to break into their present in such powerful ways that they will not only know that He is, but that they will know that He is there for them. He is truly their God and can be trusted. Last week, I showed you what the Bible says is the reason for these events. Actually, it was 2 weeks ago. Both the judgment on Egypt and the mercy shown to Israel were for one purpose, and that was that God may bring glory to Himself. Now, to understand what that means and does not mean, I would simply refer you to that sermon from 2 weeks ago. But as I said, the way that God will bring glory to Himself is both by judgment and by mercy. And so God says in Exodus chapter 7, verse 5, "And the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord." In other words, by the time the Israelites leave Egypt, even the Egyptians will know with certainty that the God exists. They will believe in God. But I contend that while the Egyptians' acknowledgement of God is certainly one of the objectives that God has here, the greater objective is that Israel will know that the Lord is God. Listen to the way that Moses said it in Exodus chapter 6, verse 7. "Then you Israelites, you will know that I am the Lord your God." Now that knowledge is not just the grudging acknowledgement of Pharaoh and the Egyptians. No, this knowledge is much more intimate. This is the knowledge of relationship. This is our God. We don't just believe in Him, we believe Him. Look please at chapter 10, verses 1 and 2. God says, "I perform these miraculous signs of mine among the Egyptians," and I might put in parenthetically, "so that the Egyptians will know that I am God." That's true. "But I perform these miraculous signs of mine among the Egyptians that you may tell your children and grandchildren how I dealt harshly with the Egyptians and how I performed my signs among them, and that you may know that I am the Lord." Now, from the perspective of hindsight, we know that the Egyptians, as I said, came grudgingly to acknowledge that there is a God and that the God of the Israelites is the God, but they didn't trust Him. They didn't believe Him. We also know, with the advantage of hindsight, that even the adults of Israel believed in God, but didn't believe Him. Getting ahead of where we are in the story, getting ahead quite a bit actually, we know that the adults of the Israelites grumbled their way across the desert, even after they had seen the mighty hand of God operating on their behalf. They grumbled their way across the desert, not even willing to enter the promised land. Because while they believed in God, they did not believe Him. Do you remember who it was that God allowed to go into the promised land? It was only those who were under 20 years of age when they left Egypt. Now look again at chapter 10, verses 1 and 2. I perform these miraculous signs of mine among the Egyptians, that you may tell your children and grandchildren how I dealt harshly with the Egyptians and how I performed my signs among them, and that you may know that I am the Lord. I don't think it's a stretch at all to suggest that the primary audience of the text that we are going to read and see in the next few moments were the children of the Israelites and their children and their children's children, and even us to this day, 3,500 years later. You know, for 1,500 years, as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, for 1,500 years, until the cross and resurrection event of Jesus, the Exodus was in fact the quintessential demonstration of the power and presence of God to His people. When you think of it through the Old Testament, there is nothing that even comes close to the kind of demonstration of the presence and power of God that you see in these chapters that we are going to look at this and the next couple of weeks. Not until the cross and resurrection of Jesus Christ. So for all of those years, for all of those children and their children, generation after generation, this is the demonstration, the most powerful demonstration, that it is God who is their God, that you may know that I am your God. I want you to join with me in these next moments in kind of reliving the events that are captured in these couple of chapters. I want you to allow the Spirit of God to capture your own imagination, as it were, with the presence and power of God, that the result may in us be the same as what God says He wishes for it to be even in the children of the Israelites. What I find interesting about these chapters, 7 through 10 of Exodus, is that they are told in such prosaic form. There's no fantastic language. It's very interesting to me that it's just a very straightforward telling of these awesome, even at times, almost incredible events. I say it's told in rather prosaic form. There are no eyewitness accounts where people cry out about their favorite lamb getting pummeled by the hail. There's no accounting here of how frightening the darkness was for those 3 days, or any kind of medical description of the boils that surfaced on all of the people and animals. Interesting, isn't it? Future generations were just to hear the basic, unvarnished truth of what their God did. That they would not only believe in Him, but that they would believe Him. Trust Him. May God's Spirit impress the same on us today, that we would come to the same end, and that is that we would truly trust Him. So I'd like to tell the story and largely in the way that the Scripture does. Now, I'm going to leave out some details because I want to come back to them in subsequent messages. And for reasons that I've already stated, I would like to tell the story, as it were, through the eyes of a 10, 12, 13-year-old boy. They were not actually present for much of what this text is going to describe. They were in a part of Egypt that was not treated in the same way that the rest of Egypt was. They would have only heard these things, as it were, secondhand, as maybe their father would have come home and told them what he had heard as he'd worked as a slave. So again, we hear it as if we were one of those 10 to 12-year-old children. I've never known being anything other than a slave. My father's a slave. His father before him was a slave. In fact, I'm told that our people have been slaves for nearly 400 years. But it wasn't always that way. There was a time when our people were free people. God was our God. We lived in a different place for reasons that I don't fully understand. We came to Egypt, and we've lived as slaves. But the same God that was our God when we were a free people, I am told, promised that we would once again be free. And every Sabbath, I'm reminded of that promise. Now, I believe that. I believe we'll be free again, but I confess I only believe it in the way that probably many of you have believed something simply because you have been told it over and over again. I don't think I actually expect to see it happen. It's just nice to believe it. But one day, not that long ago, my father and other men began to talk very excitedly about something that had happened. That is, they began to talk about the idea of us actually escaping from Egypt and going to that land that we've heard about that had been promised to us so long ago. It turns out that one of the princes of Egypt is in fact a Hebrew. And that prince came back from somewhere and he is promising to lead us out of Egypt. But I discovered that the excitement turned to disappointment very, very quickly when that Moses went to Pharaoh telling him that our God had said we were to leave Egypt, and Pharaoh said no. In fact, he made it harder than ever before for us. And my father and grandfather and the others complained bitterly. What has happened to us? Then just about a month or so ago, I heard my father talking again about this man Moses and what he was doing. I couldn't tell for sure if my father was excited about it or if he was in fact thinking it was all just foolishness. But one night he came home and he told us that he had heard that Moses had actually gone to Pharaoh again demanding that we be set free. And when Pharaoh said to Moses, "Give me some sign that I should listen to you at all, that you have any authority," Moses' brother Aaron took his shepherd's staff and threw it down in front of Pharaoh, and the staff turned to a terrible snake. Well, the Pharaoh invited his magicians to come and do the same, and they did. They threw down their staffs, and those staffs too became snakes. But what was fun to hear was when my father said that without so much as a word by anyone, that staff snake that had been Aaron's turned and swallowed up all of the other snakes. My father smiled when he told it. I had to wonder what old Pharaoh thought at that point in time. He was no match for our God, but he wouldn't let us go. I thought that was the end of the whole story, but I was very, very wrong. The very next day, early in the morning, everyone was scared and excited all at the same time. We live not that far from the Nile River. And the Nile River, that river that makes our crops grow, that river that gives life to this entire area, that river had turned to blood. The fish in the river died, and the stink from the river was terrible. The Egyptians couldn't find water anywhere because even the water in their own buckets had turned to blood. They had to dig wells in order to get water. That night, Father told us what had happened. It had been our God who had done this thing through Moses. Moses had gone to Pharaoh again and told them that God was going to punish him if he refused to let us go free. And then Moses told his brother Aaron to stretch out his staff, and his brother Aaron did it, and the Nile River turned to blood. That river that Pharaoh claims he made, that river that Pharaoh claims belongs to him, that river that the Egyptians worshipped, that river our God took control of. But what did Pharaoh do? He turned and walked away. It was a week before I heard or saw anything else. Things were getting back to normal. I thought maybe it was all over when, again early in the morning, kids came running from all over with one word on their tongues. Frogs. frogs. Now, you might think that would be an exciting thing for a 10-year-old boy. But we're not talking about a couple of frogs we're chasing through the grass. We're talking about frogs everywhere. They were in every room. They were in the beds. They were in the kitchens. They were in the ovens. They covered the places where people cooked. Not a few frogs, millions of frogs. That night we could hardly wait for Father to get home to tell us what he had heard. And yes, it was Moses. Moses again. He had waited 7 days since the Nile River had been turned to blood. He went again before Pharaoh to tell him he must let us go free or our God would plague the country with frogs. And that's exactly what our God did. And frogs came up from the Nile by the millions. Oh, the Pharaoh's magicians made frogs come up from the river too. But Pharaoh knew there was a difference. Father said the frog represents one of the Egyptian gods. The frog is the representative of the god that allows or causes people and animals to have babies. Our God had taken control of their god. This time Pharaoh had to admit that Moses' power was beyond the power of the magicians, and so he asked Moses to pray to his god that the frogs would go away. Think of it. He had to ask our God to take control of his God. And then for the first time, Pharaoh promised that if Moses would pray that, we could go free. So the next day, Moses prayed. The frogs did, in fact, go away, but there were so many of them, and they were piled into such tall piles, and they stunk as badly as the Nile River had stunk a year earlier. But God said as soon as the frogs were gone, old Pharaoh once again changed his mind, and he would not let us go. Well, when that happened, Father said, Moses told his brother Aaron to take his staff and to hit the ground. Not only did God have control of the water, the Niles, but God also has control of the land itself. And when Aaron hit the ground, all of the dust of the ground turned to gnats. Have you ever been caught in a swarm of gnats? It's not fun. They're all over you. They're up your nose, they're in your ears, they're in your eyes. You think you're going to go crazy if you cannot get away from these things. Well, Pharaoh's magicians immediately tried to match his power, but they could not match it. And even they had enough sense to realize that there was something going on here beyond their magical abilities, for they said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. Not only does Moses' God exist, not only is Moses God, in fact, in Egypt, but I want you to know, Pharaoh, that Moses God is in your homes, in our homes. He's in your very palace. There's no place where our God can be denied. But old Pharaoh was so hard that he said, no, you cannot go. The next couple of days, things went back to normal again. The frogs and the bugs were gone. And we didn't honestly know that anything had happened. Until again, Father came home that second night. He told us how once again Moses had gone to Pharaoh, threatening him that if he did not let us go free, the next day swarms of biting insects would come and cover every part of the land except where we Israelites live. And that's exactly what happened. Insects everywhere, on the ground, in the air, in their houses. Insects that bit them. These were far worse than the gnats before. Again, I have to ask, have you ever been in the middle of a swarm of mosquitoes or hornets? Imagine if they're everywhere and you can't get away from them. Our God had control of the water. He had control of the land. He has control of the air itself. Father told us as soon as the flies appeared, Pharaoh instantly called for Moses and Aaron to come back quickly and told them they could certainly go and worship their God, but we had to worship our God in the country of Egypt. Moses said, no. Our God has said we must go out of the country of Egypt. And finally, Pharaoh said, okay, but we shouldn't go far. And would we please pray to our God that he would remove the insects? Moses said he would pray, but Pharaoh better not change his mind. And Moses prayed. But Pharaoh did change his mind. Once again. It wasn't many days later when Father came home with another story, but this one we had a clue to or about before he came home. the first clue that we had that something terrible might have been happening to the Egyptians, but not to us, is when some of Pharaoh's men came inspecting our stalls and our fields. We kids kept asking questions about it until we determined that something had happened to the cattle and sheep of the Egyptians. And when Father came home that night, we discovered that that was indeed the case. Once again, Moses had gone to Pharaoh and told him to let us go free, or all of the cattle of the Egyptians would die, but not our cattle. And sure enough, the next day it happened. All their cattle died. And that's why Pharaoh had sent his men to inspect our barns and our fields. But in spite of seeing what had happened, in spite of seeing that our God has the power of death in his hands, in spite of seeing that our God has the power of determining who it is and when it is that someone dies, Pharaoh still refused to let us go. Father said that as soon as Moses and Aaron heard that Pharaoh changed his mind again, God told Moses to throw soot into the air. And as soon as they threw the soot into the air, swelling, spreading, open sores appeared on all of the people and the animals of the Egyptians. This time the magicians didn't even try to match God's power, for they were suffering so intensely from the sores themselves. But Father says, in spite of this painful attack on their very bodies, in spite of this attack on their very bodies, demonstrating God's power not just over nature, but demonstrating God's power even over the Pharaoh's own body, Pharaoh refused to give in. I wondered how much it would take before Pharaoh would get the message. I had no idea what would happen next, but I was beginning to wonder if all of this activity would come to nothing. Actually, I didn't think of that. My father said it. Again, it was a couple of days later when we got word of what happened next. Moses had once again gone to Pharaoh and warned him to let us go, or hail would come and destroy everything. In fact, Moses warned Pharaoh that he ought to tell his people to bring their cattle in so they're not killed by the hail. Not so incidentally, the hail was going to fall only on the Egyptians, not on us Israelites. Some of Pharaoh's people believed. They feared, given what had happened, and they did in fact bring their animals in, but not everyone. Some people actually took cover, but not everyone. And the next day it hailed like it has never hailed before in all of Egypt's history. And even though we weren't hailed on, we could hear the thunder, we could see the lightning. We learned that it beat down everything that was left out in the open. It stripped every tree. All the crops that had any leaves or any heads of grain were completely stripped and destroyed. Have you ever seen what even small, very small hail can do to a flowering plant? Imagine the size of hail that can kill an animal or a human being. That's what happened. It's probably in God's timing that the very time that the hail hit was the time when most Egyptians are worshiping their god, Min. It's their god of the harvest. Our God destroyed their god's work. Our God greater than their God. I wonder if anyone noticed. This time Pharaoh called for Moses and he admitted that he had sinned against the Lord. And he said, I want you to do something for us, please. I've been wrong. I need your help. I'll let the people go free if you will pray to your God to stop the hail. And so Moses prayed and the hail stopped. Once again, Pharaoh changed his mind. It's amazing, isn't it? The Pharaoh knows that our God is alive. He knows that our God is more powerful than his gods, that our God can control everything about nature, that he can instantly turn water into blood, he can create millions of reptiles and insects, he can start and stop diseases, he can kill any human being or animal anytime he chooses. Our Pharaoh even admits that he's wrong, but he still refuses to obey. Now every day we can hardly wait for our Father to get home to tell us what might be happening next, and we weren't disappointed. Once again, Moses went to Pharaoh and he threatened him to let us go, or this time locusts would come and they would eat every living plant on the ground that the hail had not already destroyed. They delivered the message and they walked out. Have you ever seen what billions of insects can do to flowering plants? I hope you've at least seen pictures of it. After the hailstorm, there was hardly anything left. Only those plants that had not yet budded remained, and then the locusts came, and they stripped absolutely everything. Even the Pharaoh's officials understood how serious this was, and they pleaded with the Pharaoh to give in. So Pharaoh called Moses and Aaron back in and said, okay, they could leave, but only the men can go. And then Pharaoh had his men force Aaron and Moses out of the palace. So God said, okay, Moses, stretch out your arm over the country. And he did, and the east wind blew in, and it carried in the locusts. They were as black. They covered the land as if it was black with the insects. Everything that was green was devoured. I think old Pharaoh quickly realized that he'd doomed his own country, for what the hail had not destroyed, the locusts were eating, and they would starve to death. Once more, he called for Moses, and he said, I have sinned against Moses, God, and would Moses please forgive him, and would Moses please pray to God to remove the locusts? And Moses prayed, and the locusts were blown away. But Pharaoh again changed his mind for the eighth time. By now, we were all sensing that something more terrible was about to happen. It seemed to us that things had gotten steadily worse. What had begun with one snake eating other snakes had grown so much more serious. Now the very lives of the Egyptians were threatened. What was next? We didn't have to wait long. Have you ever been out in the wood at night when there was cloud cover? That is, no moon, no stars, maybe so far away from any other lights that it's absolutely black. You cannot even see your own hand in front of your face. That's what happened next. Moses stretched out his hand to the sky and it became totally dark. No, not just for a few moments, but it became totally dark for 3 days. And I don't know how God did it, but where we lived, we had lights in our homes. How, I don't know, but the Egyptians had no light. Not anywhere. Not even in their homes. Can you imagine? For a people who worship the sun, what could be a greater threat than total darkness? In fact, for any of us who think of the certainty of the sun rising tomorrow and of that happening every single day without failure, even for us, what an awesome display of the power of God. And it seemed that Pharaoh had reached the end of his rope, because after 3 days, with no assurance that there was ever going to be a sun again, he called for Moses and he told Moses that all of the people could go. But even in that, Pharaoh was stubbornly refusing to completely give in. He demanded that the cattle of the Israelites be left behind. But Moses refused. In all of that, in the blood, the insects, the hail, the sores, the locusts, and now the darkness, Pharaoh became enraged. And he said if he ever saw Moses again, Moses would die. Now that was a change that none of us expected. Throughout these days, all these days, my father, it seems, has alternated between anticipation and discouragement. At times, it seemed that he was confident that now, certainly, Pharaoh would let us go. But the longer it went, and the more stubborn that Pharaoh became, the more my father wondered out loud if it was all simply hopeless. And then this happened. Now we cannot even go before the Pharaoh. Now Moses cannot even be allowed into his presence. How will we ever be set free if we do not have even the ability to talk to the Pharaoh? Hopeless is what many of us became. But what about all that we had seen in these past weeks? What about the power of God over the forces of nature? What about the power of God over life and death? What about the fact that our God controls the sun and the moon and the stars? What about how our God can tease and manipulate the mightiest king on earth? Can we believe him? Not simply believe in him. Can we believe him? Even the Pharaoh now believes in God, but he does not believe him. What will it take for us Israelites to believe him? What will it take for us to believe him? You know, I mentioned earlier that down through history, God has not always shown himself in such powerful ways. Certainly in the cross resurrection event of Jesus and the days immediately following that, some in the time of Elijah, as I mentioned earlier, certainly in this time about which I've just been speaking. But God has not always done that. God has done it, however, in ways, such dramatic ways, that he calls on his people to believe him, even when he is not acting in those ways all of the time. How would the Israelites' children and grandchildren respond in the generations to come? Would they simply believe in God, or would they believe him? What about you and me? Do we believe him? Does my God truly have that power? Does my God have the power of life and death and kingdoms and nature? Is my God able? Do I believe him? Stand with me, please, in prayer. Father, in some ways, this text presents a huge challenge because it puts before us, at the same time, the most awesome displays of your power. And yet it does it in such simplicity that I find myself, at least, wanting at times for there to be the kind of light show that people can create these days in motion pictures. I want there to be the kind of dramatic demonstration of these things that will somehow overwhelm my senses and leave me breathless on the ground, saying, "Oh yes, God, you are powerful." But you don't do that. You give us these accounts of what you've done, and you ask us to believe you. Father, help our unbelief. And I pray for those in this place this morning who are facing struggles, deep struggles. Maybe it's fear of the future. Maybe it has to do with jobs or income or whatever it might be, God. I ask that by your Spirit you would remind them today in ways that only your Spirit can, that you are their God and that you are indeed all-powerful and that you love them and that you, their God, will truly meet their need. God, help us to believe you. In the name of Jesus, amen.